Welcome to Sexy in Van City Radio 101.9 FM on CITR. Or maybe you could be one of our podcast listeners. However you've decided to spend this hour with us, we're very, very, very glad to have you. It was a beautiful blood red moon. I don't know if you got to see the eclipse this morning, but it was pretty hot, pretty amazing. I know some of you may not have because it was foggy last night and I had a few people who were complaining, oh, I got up so early and I didn't get to see it. So they're all heartbroken about it. But you know what? Just enjoy the energy of it. It's in the air. It's kind of sexy. It's also a new beginning time, which is always exciting whenever there's a new moon. It's kind of a cool time. So even if you didn't get up and howl at the moon last night, I'm sure you got that energy in your deep, sweet sleep. So one of the things you may want, if you don't have already, is a mindful relationship. Whether you want to figure out how to cultivate it, perhaps maintain it, or maybe you've been in a relationship where there's lots of bed death, where you have no sex, no intimacy, no connection, and you'd like to be able to revive that. And I don't mean like going to church and, hey, Jesus, but I mean just really just owning your own power, feeling connected, and feeling really, really, really good. So how are we going to do that? Well, I got smart and I brought in the troops. I brought in a pretty awesome guest, as always, and he is amazing. He's sitting here smiling at me in the studio. And if you haven't figured out who I'm talking about, because I haven't given you too many clues, I'm talking about the wonderful, the sexy, the talented Michael Gordon. And Michael has a Master's of Sciences. I'm just like, I don't know what M. Yeah,
Master's of Science. Yeah.
Thank you. I was like, oh my gosh, I don't know what all these initials stand for behind your name. I feel really bad and I should have asked this before the show. In consciousness and transpersonal psychology, and is a PhD candidate through the Tyburg University Graduate Program of Humanities in connection with the Dow Institute in the States. And he's received his EMDR certified training through the BC School of Professional Psychology. Michael brings a mindfulness and a biopsychological approach to his clinical work, having given numerous public talks on the relationships between everyday life, mindfulness, trauma, cognitive neuroscience, including lectures at Simon Fraser University. In 2009, he was part of a group leading meditation to women in the BC correctional facilities. He's also a fifth Dan in Aikido and trained in conflict resolution. What can you not do? A speaker.
You don't want to know.
Really? Okay. I'm very curious now. I may have to ask you that during the interview process of this, but your bio is like really extensive, like, and wonderful about just addressing the confluence of neuroscience, trauma, and contemplative mindfulness practice. And with over 20 years experience in the field of mental health and personal development, Michael offers a compassionate and sophisticated approach to treatment. An emphasis is placed on helping the client find the root causes of suffering, anxiety, or an unease from their early family history through present relationships to desired future outcomes. And from a therapeutic standpoint, the focus is on first helping the client develop emotional awareness of underlying beliefs and behavioral patterns towards making more positive, holistic choices in their life. And you also do a radio show and you sing.
Yeah, the radio show has sadly lapsed. And I also do some acting and, yeah, there's a lot going on.
Like I said, what don't you do?
Let's see, rocket science, brain surgery, the whole Buckaroo Banzai thing, yeah.
Well,
I'm not a pole dancer.
Well, thank not God. Yet.
Oh, you'll make one out of me yet.
You never know. When there's will, there's ways.
That's
we
right.
can accomplish anything. So, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you. It's exciting to have you here. And you mentioned as well, which I didn't get because your bio is quite long. I didn't get to the part. you actually have walked the halls of UBC before, haven't you? You're alumni.
Yeah, I'm getting all kinds of sense memory coming back here. I first came here to do the Arts One program many years ago.
Okay.
And let me see. Then I came back after going to McGill University and was working for the, oh my God, she's taking her clothes off, everybody. If I stop talking, it's because I'm just caught in the tractor beam of Caroline's beautiful, sexy aura.
I still have clothes on. I just had to take my sweater off because I was getting way too hot.
Yeah, well, that's even hotter when you still have something on. I came back to UBC in the capacity of working for Canadian University Press. And so there's all kinds of people out there that I worked with in the media and in the Lower Mainland, like Stuart Durden at the Province. He's the entertainment culture editor at the Province, or one of the editors, I guess. And Catherine Monk, people like that.
Mm-hmm.
So I was kind of overseeing student newspapers in BC through the UBC office. Yeah, so I have quite a bit of history here at UBC.
That's really cool. We're on the radio here because CITR has been around for a long time.
I've probably been on the show. I don't remember having a radio show, but I've been on air before. I might have guest hosted a couple of shows, but I did radio at McGill.
Yeah. Very cool. Yeah. Well, I'm glad you got to be here while we were in this building and to get you on radio here as well as McGill, which I've always wanted to go to because my last name is McGillivray, but that's kind of cheesy reason why to go to pick a university because it feels kind of sort of like a birthright. Right in some weird, strange way. But no, I've never been there.
It's a beautiful campus. And Montreal, speaking of sexy, Montreal's got to be the sexiest city like in North America.
Hush, hush. Yeah. Over Vancouver?
Oh, yeah. Vancouver is different. I mean, I would say Vancouver, actually Ottawa and Montreal. Ottawa's got lots of healthy, wholesome people. They're out there skating in winter and looking healthy and rosy. And But Montreal's got style. It's got panache. You know, Vancouver doesn't have... We're a little schlumpy here. Like we've got the Lululemon look down and the casual kind of sexy yoga look, but we don't have that European flair, and Montreal's got it in spades.
No, we don't. And I have to say, I haven't been to Montreal for a while, but I've got a few of my really good friends who live there. And when I visited, I remember being a little bit taken back just because men are really forward. And I was single at the time, so it was kind of hot. I've never been to Europe, so.
There you go. It's pretty close.
Yeah. Whereas here, there's times where you can actually go out with someone and have no idea if you're actually on a date or not, whether they're gay or straight, and not being able to pick up on the energy. And for heaven's sakes, I'm a medical Qigong practitioner. I read energy. So, and if I can't do it, and I've done a lot of research on this stuff over the years. That's kind of scary.
You know,
how does that leave the regular person?
It's an interesting point because I was having a conversation with a friend earlier today on this topic. And I think it comes, there may be a good starting point to talk about mindful relationship or dating or sexuality. Any of those, you know, kind of entry points of conversation is, it really does come down to your capacity to be vulnerable. And most of us, a great many of us, I should say, come from backgrounds where we had to curtail or restrict the natural, you know, kind of progression of vulnerability in relationship from when we were very young because of issues in our immediate environment and the safety of that environment. And I'll get into that a bit more technically, but we kind of develop a bit of this aversion and we learn to put on behaviors that will get positive feedback and approval from our parents and caregivers because sometimes we get shamed or, you know, shut down for behaviors that trigger our parents and their issues of feeling out of control or, you know, uncomfortable or whatever. So we learn very quickly to kind of clamp that down. And it's a really interesting point you bring up about socializing, because what we're learning pre-sexually as young people is to socialize, is to expand our boundary beyond the initial, dependent boundary, like that we're kind of meshed with our mother primarily. Mm-hmm. So you can see what goes on immediately there if there's birth trauma or, you know, postnatal trauma. There's all kinds of confusion energetically, emotionally, and physiologically that kind of gets stamped at that time. So that's our primary, what we call attachment there. And so that's where we're learning to expand and create and discover and be shown and have an atmosphere created where we can have increase our tolerance to socialize and for otherness. First through, obviously, platonic relationships. We first have to identify there's other people.
Yes.
Like your mother is not you, and that mobile above your crib is not you. There's other, you know, this comes from what's called object relations theory, right?
And when does that happen in terms of because I've heard that's the formative, like from 1 through 4, are usually the years that things start to establish in terms of a lot of our patterns that basically
Absolutely.
Carry us right through life unless we learn how to crack them.
Yeah, the early attachment phase of our, you know, of our socialization is critical. And this is a bit of technical stuff now, but it's so vital to understanding how we operate because neuronally and hormonally, you know, what gets wired in there, our brain grows and our how we define the world and create meaning and our identity is intertwined with how our system gets wired, kind of hardwired. And so the first thing that happens is when you're born, an infant, you know, will crawl up the mother's tummy to the breast to get breast milk. And in breast milk, oxytocin is released. And so this immediately signals the infant's brain as it emerges into the world and is breathing air and has the plugs come out of the nose and now there's, you're not in fluid anymore, that immediately you get this hit of a hormone that says, this is safe, this is good, you're bonding, you're still connected to this being that, that you know, is associated with your primary consciousness and well-being, right?
Yeah.
And now you're in this scary environment, so it's soothing and calming. And that comes in so profoundly later on, the oxytocin response. And we'll talk about that in terms of one-night stands and dating and how we get from sexual attraction into bonding with one another.
Yes.
But that's the socialization period I want to come back to because we all need to learn better vulnerability. We need to expand our capacity to be open and to be affectionate and tender-hearted beyond the scope of any sort of sexualized relationship. We need to come back to that childhood friend-making quality. And I mean this is speaking from a place of compassion and, you know, like the what the Dalai Lama talks about in terms of being open-hearted, tender-hearted. And, you know, to be able to do that more would change the landscape emotionally, what you're describing in Vancouver, where you weren't worried about what signals you were getting because it would be obvious. People are already being affectionate and open and kind of inviting to one another. So any extra twinkle of the eye or body language would go a long way to signaling you what else was going on, right? So I think what happens then is going back to the initial curtailing of our behaviors, we hold back.
Yes, we do.
We hold back, and then guess what happens? There's a rebound effect. So when you do want to make a connection with someone, sometimes you go overboard, or
and
you just
stalker.
Exactly.
Run!
or the typical thing with straight men is like, you know, we were talking about this in another conversation. You know, women have all kinds of, have much better emotional vocabulary, you know, and body language around emotional cues and physicality and affection. So you're in a bar or in a restaurant with a girlfriend and you touch each other and you touch each other's arms. When a straight guy, when you reach out and touch his arm, he's like, oh yeah, I'm getting laid. I'm so getting laid tonight. And he's completely misreading the cue because he hasn't got that expansive, relaxed sense of contact and intimacy.
So how do we create that safety and change that landscape? And the reason I'm thinking about this is because it's been a year pretty much to date where there were all the attacks on campus and there were just some attacks just in our neck of the woods in South Granville and just about women. And how do we change that fabric where people don't misunderstand and just take things where there ends up being date rape, et cetera?
Well, there has to be action and conscientious effort in many different areas. Obviously, in early childhood education, the way boys are socialized and taught.
Yes.
And of course, then that has to extend into the way that we influence media and culture and not, you know, create some social taboos around sexist behavior and rape culture. So that's all kind of very vital as we're raising the next generation. Then, of course, there's sort of more the social, political action side of things of finding ways to make rape an issue for men.
Yes.
Because we tend to only act on things when it affects us personally. And so there's a kind of dissociation there. Then we need to come back to that respect for women from a more holistic point of view, as opposed to this isn't happening to me, it's not my issue. And then, and of course, there's a defensive reaction.
Yes.
And then, of course, there's all kinds of other things that are really vital there. For on the male side of things, I would say obviously heterosexual is more predominantly important. And that comes around sexual identity and sexual intelligence, let's call it, or gender intelligence and homophobia. Because a lot of the misogynist and tolerance and enabling of rape culture, so to speak, comes from a homophobic response in men.
Wow.
Yeah, they're kind of exerting a you know, that what it is a disconnect with the vulnerable side of themselves as a lashing out, a projection onto women. Because as we know, sexual assault is about power. It's never about sexual fulfillment.
No.
It's never about sex.
Yeah.
No. So, you know, let's come back around to what our initial point was for the show, was to talk about mindfulness. And mindfulness is really just awareness of what's going on and emotionally for ourselves and in any dynamic. And so, you need to educate young people, young men, primarily young boys, to be emotionally intelligent, be empathic. But if you are not conditioned early on in your attachment phase to be vulnerable, you can't develop empathy. You become disconnected and very insular.
So in a city like Vancouver, and when I say Vancouver, I mean Metro Vancouver.
Yes.
That is incredibly multicultural, which I've always been really proud of. How do we do that where there's so many different ways of raising children?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think the thing is to focus on relations and relational practice and relational, I guess I'll come back to the word intelligence, and making that a priority. And it's one of the things that I'm not aware of, you know, that I really want to take on as a project to make it a priority. We have home ec, we have shop class. Why is there not relational training to learn how to be better in relationship with one another? And that's cross-cultural, which brings us to a really interesting point. We want to make sure we cover this topic that comes from cross-cultural research. And one of the big influences on this in this area worldwide and part of our conversation is a marriage therapist from New York named Esther Perel. Brilliant woman. Yes, and she wrote a book called Mating in Captivity.
I love that
She's a Belgian Jew. Her parents were Auschwitz survivors, or maybe they didn't survive. I'm not quite sure, but that, you know, that's part of her history.
Mm-hmm.
And so she was very interested. You mentioned the word safety. And safety is also important outside of the realm of actual physical safety.
Yes.
In terms of emotional safety. And we break that down into the emotional safety and how that translates into, you know, women have to be able to feel safe emotionally in a relationship, not just walking down the street.
Yes.
To be able to feel, because again, tend to have a higher capacity to be vulnerable, because within female culture, it's more, you know, more of an a tolerable trait and an enhanced trait. So she did all this original research on from couples from all many different cultural backgrounds. I think it was like 120 couples or something.
I think so.
Pretty good data pool. And what she found was very consistent. And it comes back to what I was saying before about how we learn to tolerate others. And I don't mean tolerance in terms of what you like or don't like. I'm talking about that this is not your mummy. This is a different person than you, and they have... They are sovereign unto themselves with their own needs and their own moods and their own way of being in the world. And when that goes badly, we stay in the narcissistic stage and the spoilt little irrational child phase of everything's about me, and we don't develop that natural empathy.
Yeah.
And so this creates what's called entitlement. So we're looking for somebody to fulfill our needs, our sexual desire, our desire for, you know, security. And so what she talks about is that there, for anybody in relationship, regardless of whatever culture, there are sort of competing forces at work. The two big pieces are safety and desire. So we all want to feel a sense of abandonment into wild lust and desire and mystery. And we want that person to come along. It captures our, you know, our gonads and our and our sexual fantasy and imagination and our you know, makes our blood, you know, come
alive. We want that honeymoon period, we want the fairy tale,
and we want that to take over. We want to be swept away by that. It's not just a fantasy in our mind, it's we want the feeling of surrender into desire. The problem is that's the initial thing that gets you interested in somebody.
Yes,
your body
it does.
Sets off chemicals. But once you cross the threshold and start when you consummate, mm-hmm. and you know, and have sexual relations with someone, a whole different set of chemicals are given off, and oxytocin. We're back to oxytocin. You signal back to that infant stage of bonding, and then it becomes about, now I want to be attached to this person, which is much more powerful for women. Women have a much harder time with one night stands because they bond pretty much immediately. And for men, vasopressin is the sort of the equivalent, and that's released maybe a little bit, has a longer delay on it, longer fuse. It takes a couple of times, and then a guy starts to feel pretty attached. Mm-hmm. I'm talking about, you know, men and women gender-wise, not in terms of sexual orientation. So now you have these competing forces. And then the bigger picture she talks about is, it's not just bonding and wild desire and mystery. That's part of it. That's what leads, I'm getting to bed death.
Yes.
You really turned on, you're lusting after someone, they're not you. And it's really sexy that you're not me, and that, can I get you?
Yeah.
Then you get them and you've got a problem because now you own them. And it's like the child with the toy that's no longer interested in the toy. They're playing with the box that it came in.
Yeah.
They become bored. They become entitled and have ownership over this person.
So how does one keep that hunter thing kicked in?
Okay, so this is the thing is to,
without taking away from the safety, so that the partner doesn't feel that they can open up and be vulnerable within the relationship, where it's that happy balance. Like, it's a delicate balance.
Fantastic question. And I think the first thing is to develop mindfulness and responsibility for ourselves as individuals, and to always remember that person is an other person than you. I think the bigger lens on that is for men. You know, because men don't develop as naturally, and the culture doesn't educate us, enable us to remember that we're responsible for our feelings and our hormones, and we're not entitled to a sexual partner because she looks good on the street, to catcall her or to grab her ass or whatever it is. That's your desire. You have to manage that.
Yeah.
It sounds so basic. It's kind of absurd. But that's what the level we're functioning on. It's like little kids who literally are grabbing out for what they think is mine.
We just had a shooting last year in the States about that, where because he was angry because blonde hair, blue eyed girls were not dating guys that look like him.
Yeah, that's someone with a really deeply disturbed,
and that's an extreme case, obviously.
It is, but it's on a spectrum. It's really important to remember that it's on a spectrum.
Okay.
So I'm going to get back to your question before I lose that thread. How do we do that? So in Esther's work, what she talks about is it's the otherness. It's maintaining the separateness. So what she found is there was a couple of ways. I hope I can remember this. The most built-in way is literally if your partner has to travel for work or you're separate from them. So you're not guaranteed they're going to be home every night. It's not easy for you to slip into boredom with one another. You kind of have to dwell in that tricky place where you have to own your anticipation or your resentment that they're not there, you know, to be with. And then, of course, there's some excitement built in there. So that's one way. The separateness also comes from separate identity. So she talks about when you first meet someone that you're going to be with. She's talking about long-term relationships here, just for anybody who's listening. This is not just automatic for you know, sexual attraction. Mm-hmm. That you see that person initially with awe, with wonder. And so this conversation could go so many directions. She talks about her current work is talking about affairs and why affairs happen, which is really fascinating. But you can see where this kind of goes. You see the person with a sense of awe. So if you get bored in a relationship, all of a sudden your attention strays and you see another other, and they look really sexy to you from your meat and potatoes that you've been with. And it's because you've lost that exoticness of your partner. And so if you have that built in, like, for example, your partner is at home listening to you do your radio show, sitting there going, that's my partner. She's doing this awesome radio show and listen to her sexy voice. And he's not entitled to that. He doesn't own that. That's your gig. And so he's got to kind of behave and still kind of be on his dating behavior to make sure he maintains that. And here's the interesting thing. How do we know that's at play? And this is my observation. I didn't get this from Esther Perel. But we know that's at play because what happens when you fight? Can I swear?
Yes, you can swear. Okay. You can say fuck.
We want to fuck each other when we fight. When we're at each other's throats, all of a sudden we're smacked into, oh my God, you don't agree automatically with what I'm feeling right now. You're not tuned into what I need. You're not narcissistically trained on me.
Yeah.
You're being that other person again. Oh my God, I want to fuck you now. Which is why we have makeup sex. So that's proof of what the how powerful the otherness is. So it's really about making sure that you pick somebody else that you really admire and awe, and then maintaining, having something, working at having that separateness built in.
Very cool. Which, considering everybody, when they get into a couple, I think my favorite one, have you ever seen the movie Bridget Jones' Diary, where you've got the smug married couples going around the table? They actually kind of look like each other. They say hello the same way.
Yes. Yeah, it's called enmeshment.
Enmeshment.
And this is the phase that you're naturally in when you're in your mom's womb. You're enmeshed, and but you don't have any consciousness of it. You don't identify with it. And what's supposed to happen is slowly you separate out. You realize I'm my own person. I have my own. And now you start to have your own friends. Mm. And then around, you know, pubescence and adolescence, well, puberty, I should say, you start to discover sexual feelings, and you start to realize I'm a sexual person other than my parents, however that emerges for you.
Thank God.
Yes, thank God. But, you know, it's fascinating how if all of that is not, again, mindful, why do we pick our abusive dads or our emotionally unavailable moms or the other way around? Why do we keep doing that?
Do you want me to answer that one?
Sure. Why don't you take a stab?
I honestly believe, and I'm a huge fan of Dr. Harville Hendricks, who has written some amazing things. And I think I'm probably going to mispronounce this, but the Imago Technique.
Absolutely right.
Where we basically are attracted to people. There's the pheromone part where you just want to fuck somebody so badly because you're going to have really good babies with them. There's that piece. But then there's the second piece, which is we're attracted to people, which is why sometimes it feels like you're dating the same person over and over again, because you're trying to resolve those issues from childhood.
That actually comes from Freud. He took that from Freud.
It's Freud.
Yeah.
Okay.
And I'm giving a big tip here.
Please.
It's a free therapy tip. This is what Freud described. Well, first of all, the word projection, we throw that word around. That comes from Freud. He's talking about projecting onto others, your therapist, your partner, whatever, either the negative or the idealized traits of your parents. And then from there, you get what's called a repetition compulsion. This comes back to the mindfulness part. So if you're not aware of what your issues are, your subconscious keeps recreating the scenario in an unconscious way to try and fix it. Let's try it again. And you keep it. And so this is what's so maddening is you're going, okay, I did that last relationship. Now I'm going to pick something different. And it looks different. The packaging looks different. The smell, the flavor, everything's like, you know, it's a totally different spice, right?
But at the core, it's the same thing.
Yeah, it blows up in your face. And that's because you're compulsively choosing from the same place. It's not a conscious place. And so that's something to be very aware of in terms of when we talk about mindful relationship. It really is kind of, in a way, therapeutically looking at what your own issues are, where they come from, what you're, you know, what Esther says in her book, in her work is, if you tell me how you were loved, I will tell you how you love. Mm. If I know how you were loved early in your life, I can tell you exactly how you love in a relationship. Now, the other great tip for people, I can't remember the name of the author of this book, but there's a great book called Wired for Love.
Okay, I have not read that one.
And it's a great book for understanding these, because we all develop different attachment styles based on, you know, so there's broadly put two categories. You're either securely attached, you had a good mommy and daddy situation going on, or, you know, co-parenting or whatever, same-sex parenting or single parenting, but you had good foundation of secure, consistent, secure love, or you're insecurely attached, and those break down into different categories. And so some people are clingers, some people are avoiders, and it helps to really know what's going on with your neurochemistry as a result of how you get triggered into the state you get triggered into, and that stuff. You're going right back to the trigger that you had when you were an infant and you were being negatively affected by your parents, you know, either neglect or their overprotectiveness or whatever it is.
That's kind of a scary thought, actually.
Yeah. You know, one of the things I quote a lot to my clients is that there was a study done, I believe it was in Germany, and a woman was looking at bonding and how drug addiction of a parent, of a mother, would affect the bond. So she took a mother and toddler, an infant, into a study room, and they stayed connected for a few minutes, and then she had the mother leave. Now, predictably, the infant went into absolute abject separation anxiety, started wailing and screaming and crying, because all they know is that really somatic, like body emotion. It's all in one, right? And the absence of that is just, the world has ended, right? They brought in a female mother chimpanzee. Within seconds, the baby was clinging to the chimpanzee and calmed down. That attachment is so profoundly important and immediate that a child won't even notice that it's a different species. And we see this in animal videos all the time. Other animal species will, like piglets will suckle at a tiger, right? So that tells you what's going on. If you have any kind of issues with early attachment, you know, it's vital that you become aware and mindful when you go looking for a relationship or to have a healthy relationship.
I'm so curious how that intermixes with Chinese medicine, because in Chinese medicine, for the first 4 years, there's the belief that, well, there's the belief first and foremost that each person has their physical, emotional, mental, and spiritual, what we call Wei Qi fields, that are about 2 feet off the body altogether that protect you. But a child actually shares the mother's fields for the first 4 years. And I've always been curious about how that affects. And I've thought about this a lot because I know BC Women's Hospital was looking for donors to donate milk, breast milk for the kids. And how would that affect drinking milk from somebody else that is not their parent? And I've been very curious about that. But as far as I know, I don't believe there's any studies that I'm aware of anyway.
No, that would be fascinating, kind of a parallel there to that animal study. Mm-hmm. You know, the other thing as well, you mentioned pheromones. Mm-hmm. A whole host of chemical sub-assessments kind of happen, or, you know, assays are happening in the body and in the brain and the nervous system when you kiss somebody. Mm-hmm. You're actually, you know, kind of processing their DNA. So it's not just the pheromone. The pheromone is the attracting substance, but you're actually sampling their DNA through saliva, and that your body is assessing the DNA match in terms of, are they going to be a good, you know, father, mother, caregiver, etc.
Wow.
Yeah, you're picking up, and plus the visual cues, right? But you're picking up on an unconscious level and all that kind of like encoded information. It's pretty powerful. So, you know, one of the things that I've noticed personally for myself at great cost, and also I guess I would say, you know, academically or intellectually or through theory and research, is chemistry can be really wrong. And so, you know, coming back to why people keep asking, you know, as in preparation for today, well, what do you mean mindful dating? And I'm going to a mindfulness and higher education conference this weekend. Mm. Well, what do you mean mindfulness? What does that mean? And it means like, well, what does it mean that chemistry can be wrong? The thing that we're relying on in an animal way to sort of signal us, yes, this is a good choice, is just a very narrow interpretation of the other person. It's like, you know, when you're hungry or you've smoked a joint and you go into the supermarket and you see a brownie, your brain is telling you, oh, fuck yeah, eat that. That's good, right? Especially if you haven't eaten. Oh, yeah, bag of chips. Good choice. And you don't debate that, right? It just appears true, and much like any other psychological, you know, obstacle, like with negative thoughts. And, you know, whatever state you're in will determine your capacity to make rational choices. So if you're relying on chemistry, you're missing out on a whole bunch of other really important, you know. So we associate diving in through chemistry with abandon, and this is wild, and it's kind of spontaneous, and it must be meant to happen because we can't hold ourselves back. And my feeling is, you want to have all the other things in check. What kind of situation will feel safe for you? What you're looking for? What attributes, maybe, that you were missing in your parents that you might be projecting subconsciously onto another person? And what kind of needs you really want to get met? Maybe you had an emotionally unavailable father or mother, and you want a partner who's going to be really tuned in and gentle with you and non-judgmental of you. with things that you struggle with emotionally. And, and so it's important to know that, because if you don't, you're going to actually pick the opposite and then go, why the hell did I get so burned by that person? Because it's your, what Jung called your shadow. Your shadow is picking. Just like your hunger and your poor impulse control when you're high or you're hungry is picking the Twinkie in the supermarket. So mindfulness is really about being in the right state. And, you know, it's hard, because I say this a lot in conversation, formally and informally, in terms of inside, outside of therapy. They're really powerful forces. And it's hard to be alone and sit with your shit. It's hard to sit with your loneliness and what it brings up in terms of existential or your life stage. You know, I'm in my 40s, and there's all kinds of concomitant issues that go along with being in your 40s and childless and as a man, too. And so there's powerful stuff at play that make it really difficult to say no.
Yeah.
It's hard to go to the supermarket when you're starving and discipline yourself to buy vegetables.
On that note, I want to ask, online dating.
Oh,
and the reason I'm asking about this,
people can't see, but I'm tearing my hair out and banging my head against the wall.
Oh,
sorry.
Sorry, sound quality. The reason I'm asking is I remember when it first started, and I was doing a dating column at the time and had just gotten out of a relationship. So it was super raw. So I basically wrote about all my friends' adventures, because I could live vicariously through them, because I was way too raw and I needed to just be me for a little bit on my own to heal. And one of my friends described it, and to be honest, I still think of it that way, where it is like going shopping online. And in terms of going full circle Chinese medicine wise, they say that we are a lot healthier liver health, because our liver is where we make our decisions in our body. Like 200 years ago, where we lived off the land, we ate the same thing every day. What are you having for breakfast? Swill. What are you having for dinner? Swill. What are you having dinner? Oh, gee, oh boy, swill. Right. That sounds swell. But we didn't have to make any choices about that. A lot of times there was arranged marriages as well, mm-hmm. where it was somebody that you knew, same small community, etc. And sometimes there is part of me that wonders, are we better off that way in some ways? Like, what's the pro and con with that? Because with online dating, and one of my friends, like you said, just it's like shopping online where you can't decide, where you just want to look at everything. And it's really hard to invest the time in a relationship and play the get to know you game with somebody and really find out what's actually underneath all those wonderful, delicious chemistry stuff. And finding out, do we have the same value system?
Yes.
Do we have the same wants for what we want in life? Like, do I want kids? Do I not want kids?
Absolutely, the big
all
ones.
All those pieces, yeah. Like even money, like that's mm-hmm. probably a huge one. Like in probably it is a huge one in terms of spending habits. It all comes down to values. And mm-hmm. how do we do that in a culture that is so embracing online? And yet at the same time, I do have some friends who have found really happy relationships sure. that way too. But I guess what's freaking me out is for our kids, they've kind of grown up, a lot of the kids that are coming up, where they've never not known the internet. And so that's going to change the fabric of how I've been able to learn how to date and have relationships right. versus now. And how do we guide and make sure that A, that they're going to be okay? And then my second half of the question is, for all of us who have been probably online dating for the last 10, 15 years, I guess now, it's mm-hmm. been a while, so where it's just kind of normal, quote-unquote.
I'm really excited to answer this question. There's so many interesting aspects to it. The thing that immediately comes to mind is that when you bring up the idea of eating the same thing every day and having routine, mm-hmm. what does that do? What does that do to our brain? What does it do to our physiology? First of all, the security allows us to habituate to safety. We're okay. Mm-hmm. We've got a steady supply of food. Another study that was done with macaque monkeys who have similar sort of social styles to us in terms of behavior and communication and family unit. And they had the mother go and forage for pellets out of these tubes. And so when the mother went away a long time, and then came back, or whether the mother went and came back very quickly. And then the third option was the mother went, and sometimes there was food and sometimes there wasn't. And it was that mode, the last one, that caused the most distress. So the offspring could adjust to a long time away or a short time away, but they couldn't adjust to an erratic time away. So for ourselves, if you think about it, it makes sense. In monasteries, they give you swill. They give you, or rice, right? You have a very simple meal, probably more than that, but just being simplistic here. You have a very simple meal. So what does that do? It creates a kind of inhibition of your attention. That means a focus of your attention on the food. So there's some mindfulness, and takes away your uninhibited, your lack of inhibition around distractions, right? What your mind is going all over the place all the time. Now this actually plays out so that you can sort of just be thinking, being in the moment, okay? Now this happens all the time because we find ourselves doing the opposite. You're sitting watching TV, mindlessly eating a bag of Cheesies, and but you can't stop yourself. And so we're back to the compulsion. You've lost that control of your prefrontal cortex, which is your impulse, your decision-making control, and you're in automatic mode. Another cheesy. So this is what we do, and that behavior can show up anywhere. And it's really, really disturbing and fascinating data now about online pornography, which I think is really valuable for us to look at the online experience, whether it's gaming or pornography or dating. It all has the same effect on the brain. And the simplest way to explain that is, in terms of all of this is acting on the reward circuit in the brain. So you develop some kind of interest in something, and this is about relationship too, interest in a person, right? And so the thing is to, we're going back to what, how do we maintain the spark, right? Is you keep finding new rewards that are not predictable.
Okay.
And so it becomes exciting all the time. But if we look at the reward circuit and dopamine, which is the pleasure hormone in the brain, you kind of build this circuit around anticipating something. So when it comes to compulsive behavior, I kind of lost my train of thought there. I was talking about...
Compulsive behavior.
Oh, online, right. So what happens is, in terms of the arousal wave, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you think about, oh my God, I'm so hungry. When I get home, I'm going to make a really good dinner. And you build up this anticipation, or I'm going to make love with my partner, right? And you build up some anticipation, you have to wait for them to get home, and then there's this payoff, and then you fall asleep together. Okay, so there's this kind of big bell curve of pleasure. And if you think about a drug, as a recreational drug, or say, going drinking with your friends, you get sort of to a peak moment of being uninhibited and on alcohol or, smoking pot or whatever, or ecstasy or something. Not advocating those things. but just talking about how the pleasure circuit works in the brain. And then there's a cascade, down as you come off the wave, and you kind of ride it out, and you hopefully come back to some sort of steady baseline that you got a good life and good self-esteem, and it's not just artificially replacing that. When it comes to online electronic stimulation, there's some great research by a guy, you can find him on a TEDx talk, not TED Talks, but TEDx is the sub conferences that are held regionally. And I think he was from Denmark, maybe. I can't remember where he was from, but he was looking at online pornography. And what happens is that response becomes less like, I have a couple of drinks, I get a little bit peaked in terms of, giddiness, and then I, come down, right? And it gets a euphoric feeling, then you come down. And it's more like crack. So with crack cocaine, you get a really sharp high, and then it drops very quickly. So you need to keep using. That's why crack is so addictive, because it's working on the dopamine circuit in the brain, and you keep needing to keep the high threshold. Otherwise, you fall really far off the cliff down, past the point of a baseline of okayness, where your body's not producing dopamine anymore. So you're kind of up. It's like standing on your tippy toes. Same thing happens when you're looking online at pornography. It's not about the pleasure arousal circuit of, getting off. I'm going to use a classic, example of getting off in a magazine, right? Where you have to get the magazine, and then it's like you have to, some work involved, right?
Yeah.
But when it's online, it's like click, 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 click. And it's about the clicking and the compulsiveness of the clicking and keeping that wave very high and very short, like choppy little wave.
Wow.
With a really high threshold, because you're like, oh my God, there's another one. And that's what online dating is like. There's another profile. Maybe this is the profile.
Yes.
And I think there's a really negative effect, feedback effect that goes on there, because you're not really looking anymore.
Yeah.
You're just eating a bag of chips mindlessly. So there's some really positives, good positives. Obviously, they're well, you know, documented and common sense.
Yeah.
Women can screen out people online for safety, and men. You can sort of pre-select attributes and mm-hmm. have an immediate sense of their photo. But a lot of that can be, is obviously people put on fake profiles and fake photos. There's a lot of minefields out there. But that aspect of it, and I've done this personally, I think in some ways gets in the way of actually being tuned into the actual quality of experience that you want with another person.
Yeah. No, that makes sense. It's kind of like being able to Google somebody these days, where sometimes it's just something nice about getting to know them without all that, where you get to ask those questions and discover all that stuff. It's exciting. so many men over the years because her husband's evolved every day.
That's right. I know that book, and that's a brilliant, that's a brilliant story.
And just having to find that where you can keep falling in love over and over again. Perhaps that's why I like the movie The Notebook so much, which is so cheesy, but where he has to make her fall in love with him every day. Yes, those cheesies. Yeah, romantic movies that make me sob.
So, can I make a quick plug before I forget, just because people may be listening and want to know where to find out more? So I have an online radio show called The Mind Whisperer, and you can just look that up. It's on a site called blogtalkradio.com, but you can also download it from iTunes for free, and I've got about 75 shows on there. We talk about a lot of these things.
And I also wanted to say, if anybody's listening and they may need some assistance with their relationship or with some internal work, where can they find you?
Thank you very much. So my practice is called Mindful You Therapy. That's Y-O-U, mindfulyoutherapy.com. I'm in Central Vancouver. I work with individuals, couples, and obviously working on this kind of stuff, and can help you find or work on your, you know, heal your own issues to be ready for that relationship.
Thank you so much for being on the show.
Oh, it's been such a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Up next is not Hans von Klaus's Misery Hour, but the amazing Pyra. And she is going to be on with the lovely Vampires Ball at 11. You've been listening to Sexy in Van City Radio 101.9 FM on CITR. We will be back next week at the sexy hour of 10 o'clock. Have a beautiful night, everyone. Mwah.